Now, if they are not fully clairvoyant, and they are not, how will they know who or what they are dealing with? Is it permissible to state what actually takes place?
Yes, it is.
If a place is being haunted, then it means that there is some undesirable entity present. The entity emanates an unpleasant thought form or thought pattern. People become aware of the presence of such an entity without being able to say how they are aware. In some cases they can see the entity. In other cases they can feel the entity, but when they are completely non-clairvoyant, the person who is being haunted gets a great feeling of unease. Strange impressions cross his mind. 162. And even the least clairvoyant knows that there is something wrong. Those who can do exorcism are people with a strong thought wave, that is, they can project the thought of something very strongly. Now, a clergyman who has got himself thoroughly hypnotized in the belief that he is doing something as the Lord's right hand, and sometimes the left hand as well, gets his thought wave boosted up because of his self-induced hypnotism. He thinks he is the answer to the maiden's prayer, or possibly the answer to the Lord's prayer would be more suitable. But he is so sure of himself that he turns all the knobs on full in his thought processes, and the entity who is doing the haunting doesn't like it a bit. He thinks, in effect, "Oh good gracious me, I can't stick this fellow. If he's going to hang around like this, I'm off." And so the haunting force takes off the pastures new where there are no clergymen who are going to project unpleasant thoughts. And that is all there is to that. It is just a matter of telepathy, because no matter what anyone believes, every person is telepathic to a certain extent. It has been proved, for instance, that even when a non-telepath, self-proclaimed, was put to a test, when he thought at a non-telepathic victim, he could influence the pulse and the blood pressure sure of his test subject. That has actually been proved. Quite a lot of things have been proved about clairvoyance and telepathy, but they have not been made public because gory murders are much better selling attractions. Here is a touch of humor. It is a paragraph from a letter to me. It is headed E.S.P.A. Further illustration to the accuracy of your writings is this. A woman writes in our newspaper to say that she cannot get a night's sleep if the sheets or pillowcases have stripes on them. She can feel the stripes. It doesn't matter if the light is on or not, she doesn't have to see those stripes to know that they are there, and they disturb her sleep. Oh yes, that was a quotation, apparently, from some English newspaper. I wish I knew which newspaper it was. Here is a question which could be interesting. The question is, would you explain the destiny of the evolution of the plant and animal kingdoms? A lot of people believe that plants evolve into animals, and 163. Animals evolve into humans, but that is not so. You have never heard of a horse turning into a cow, have you? And you have never heard of a lettuce leaf turning into a bird. The animal kingdom, the human kingdom, and the vegetable kingdom are things completely apart, things completely different, and I am telling you in all seriousness, this is not a joke by any means, it is the absolute truth. On certain other planets, animals take the place of humans. On other planets, the vegetable kingdom reigns supreme. For example, there is a planet where plants such as trees are able to manage a slow mode of locomotion. They pick up their modified roots and move to a different location, and sink their roots down again that they may absorb the necessary nourishment. So the evolution is this: a cabbage may not be very conscious on this earth from the human standpoint, but even so cabbages can recognize people and they can recognize emotions. Oh, you don't believe that? Well, that has already been proved, that has been proved in laboratory tests. So that if your Auntie Macassar was a happy old soul, her Aspidistra would be happy too and would grow better and have a better color. While the plant of Melissa Mugwump, a sour old biddy, would also be affected and would have poor color and stunted growth. The moral in this seems to be: smile sweetly on your potatoes and they will grow better for you. Evolution is ever upwards,
So the vegetables and plants with which we are today acquainted on this earth will in time become sentient, highly intelligent persons of the plant world in a different evolution, in a different incarnation. Animals also grow upwards in spiritual stature. It doesn't mean to say that your pet cat is suddenly going to start out and paint pictures better than Rembrandt or suddenly start making radios on the kitchen table. No, their values are quite different. Their values consist of spiritual attainment, just as in the old days before the advent of communism and the television and press. In the far, far East, only things of the spirit mattered, things of purity, things of true religious thought. People earned enough money to keep them alive so that they could progress through this earth and not have to come back to it. Humans, then, in the far-off days, were better people than the humans of today. 164. Because nowadays humans are contaminated with TV, contaminated with the press, and contaminated with too many commercial interests. It doesn't matter nowadays in the West how good living a person is, all that matters is, how big is his bank account. In that latter reading I don't amount to anything at all. But I do know quite a few things about the spirit, and a person cannot take his bank account with him to the other side. My bank account is knowledge, knowledge which I can take with me when I go. Curiously enough, I have just got another question about that: have minerals on any planets got intelligence? And the answer is a definite yes. Now, I have already told you that on certain other planets the carbon molecule is not the building brick of that system, it may be a silicate, and there are stones of silicate composition who are actually thinking, moving entities. If you could go over and see them, you can't, so don't bother your Trav1 agent. You would have to stay a whole lifetime before you saw even a twitch of movement, because if a creature can live for a million or 2 years, then speed of locomotion doesn't matter greatly. So moving stones take their time. They are about as slow as the people I had to move my stuff quite recently. Hey, do you know something? Now that I thought I had finished dealing with transmigration, another question comes up. Here it is. It is said the body changes molecule for molecule every 7 years. What actually happens? Certain Eastern books which give this information could be distorted in translation. This is for those who doubt changing of bodies. Well, let us give an imaginary case, shall we? Little Billy Smith can't get on with life, everything goes wrong for him, and he is sick and tired of living on Earth where everyone seems to be on his back. He contemplates suicide, which surely is a stupid thing to do, because if he commits suicide he will be slapped back to Earth in a worse condition. But anyway, before he does knock himself off, he gets a message during his sleep. Tom Thomas, who is in the astral, wants to come back to Earth to do a special job, and Tom Thomas has arranged with a special counsel who controls such things that Billy Smith can part from his body provided he allows Tom. 165. Thomas to take over. So Billy Smith doesn't think much, at first, of somebody else taking over his messy clay body, but as the days go by the more he thinks about it the more ready he becomes to agree. So a deal is made. Billy Smith lies down somewhere, the silver cord is parted, but before it can be completely severed it is connected to a silver cord sprouted by Tom Thomas, and Tom Thomas, a gentleman of the astral, then enters the body of Billy Smith. Poor Tom shudders in dismay almost as soon as he gets there. The body is inefficient. The muscles are flabby. The feet don't seem to go where they are directed, and the eyes don't focus very well. In addition, there is a really awful stench from the body. Never mind, Tom will get used to it in time, but he will find that the body isn't too satisfactory. He will be like a pilot in an aeroplane, a pilot who has flown aircraft before but not this particular model. The pilot sits there jittering with fright while he looks at all the different dials and knobs, etc., and then gingerly he puts out his hand to get the machine working. Soon he is able to control the body. But there is always this terrible feeling that one is in an alien body, and that becomes intolerable. So the molecules of that borrowed body, that taken over body, are changed molecule by molecule, so that at the end of 7 years the body of Billy Smith is no longer of the same composition. Everything has been changed, and now there is the body of Tom Thomas. And Tom Thomas is happy again, more or less, because he has the body to which he is accustomed. In the days of long ago, high priests were able to teach people how to do these things. It was much like going to a car showroom and having the head salesman there demonstrate new models. Bodies could be tried out to see which one was most suitable, and as I have said previously, in Atlantis and Lemuria, special no-ownership bodies were kept available for traveling gardeners of the Earth. The bodies were used in much the same way as one rents a car, goes on journey, and returns the car. A question here is, yetis. Many claim to have seen them and photographed them in various parts of the world. Is this correct? Are the heads, hands, etc. on show in certain places? 166 just manufactured objects to attract visitors? It is a strange thought, isn't it? People have gone to the moon, robot ships have gone to Mars, and other robot ships are going to other worlds, yet man has not yet thoroughly explored nor investigated all aspects of this world. There are many parts of the Earth, in Canada, for instance, and Alaska, Tibet, India, and Africa where humans have never been, and in those remote areas there are remnants of a race which should have expired centuries before. Yes, there are yetis. These people are the last dregs of a race which has left the Earth except for them. Think of people trying to drain a lake of fish. For some reason the people owning the lake want all the fish out so it can be restocked with a different type. They use nets and all sorts of other devices to catch the fish and transport them elsewhere, and then the lake is restocked with a different species of fish. But from time to time there are reports of one or two fish of the original type who have briefly been seen but not caught. You can't catch everything. A fish may be a pregnant fish, a twerp, I believe the correct term is. It may be hidden in a small hole in a rock and so escape the nets, and when that fish shoots out her eggs or whatever she does, and the eggs hatch, then more fish are born. We get the same thing here on Earth in the remotest areas. But it's a good thing they are in remote areas because there are so many bloodthirsty people who want to go out and shoot themselves a yeti so they can have his skin in front of the fireplace or something. As for many of the specimens, well, you can go to a waxwork museum and you can see some remarkable people there, but they are only wax figures, aren't they? I shouldn't believe too strongly in the claims that here at last is the body of the yeti. Question: what are the pyramids? Where did they originate? How were they built? What is the real use of them? And will a pyramid-shaped object preserve things? That is meant to be a question. It seems like a whole load of questions to me, but let us see what we can do about it. Pyramids are nothing but marker beacons. If you live near the sea or a river which is used by ships, you will see buoys in the water. If you live near an airport, you will see marker. 167. Beacons to guide aircraft. A pyramid is that shape because that is the most enduring shape and because it has four sides which can help reflect a signal. In the days when the gardeners of the Earth came to this world, they came in spaceships, and the spaceships had to be guided in just the same way as a ship entering port has to be guided by the coloration and configuration of objects anchored in the water. When these pyramids were built, there were many other devices on the Earth which now have been lost to man, devices, for example, which could nullify the effects of gravity. Then one could put a sort of clamp on a huge block of stone and turn a switch and adjust a knob, and the block would rise up into the air and it could be guided to its destination. This is not fiction. This is fact. Let me tell you something. In the USA, a special hotel was built. It was built first as a framework with a lot of pigeonholes, and then a powerful motor was fixed on the top of special boxes. Each box was a completely equipped room, and the motor was started and rotor blades lifted the box up to the right height when it could be slid into one of these pigeonholes. I saw this in, I think, Practical Mechanics not too long ago. I wished I could have produced the picture for you. It was interesting. so the pyramids were built by anti-gravity machines. The Sphinx? You ask about that also. The Sphinx is a special marker device marking the location of a great hoard of treasure hidden beneath. The treasure in this case is a museum of the arts and sciences of a long bygone age. That is the purpose of the Sphinx. Oh, in case you didn't know, there are quite a few pyramids throughout the world. Egypt does not have a monopoly of pyramids. There have been pyramids in Mexico and in Brazil, in certain parts of China, and in various other locations, and, I repeat, they were just marker beacons. Spaceships could home on the signals emitted from these pyramids and then come into the desired spaceport. That, I repeat most solemnly, is the absolute truth, it is not fiction. Here is a question which will interest many of you. The question is, where is the lower astral? What is it? 168. The lower astral is a place, or zone, or time continuum where the vibrations are two-dimensional instead of three, where conditions are not harmonious. It is an astral zone where thought is not clear, where it is not possible to create artistic ally. It is what one might term a twilight zone, and just think of this, you are looking at a picture in the dusk and you cannot see the colors, can you? You may be able to determine the subject of the picture, but the dusk stops the colors and you may see instead a more or less uniform set of grayish tones. You have to have daylight in order to see colors. In the same way, if one goes to the astral above this earth, one can see colors which are not visible on this earth, but if one goes to the lower astral, that is, if one is caught in this mesh of lower vibrations, one cannot even see the tawdry colors which one can see upon this earth. 169. Chapter 10. Or, look at the out guy with the wheels, shrieked the young gentleman in the shopping center. Gee, breathed his sleazy companion, well, ain't that sharp? Eyes darted right and left, gawking at any passing thing that caught their vapid attention. The two young men slouched off. In the near distance, a slow-moving figure reluctantly detached himself from the self-imposed task of supporting a concrete pillar. Chewing hard, he lurched over and, with the skill of long practice, parked a wad of well-chewed gum on the side window of the nearest store. Hands hooked in his belt, he stood wide-legged and still chewed from long habit. "Sa-a," he uttered eventually. "That sure is a mighty fine rig you got there. Steer it with your feet?" Not waiting for an answer, he deftly retrieved his parked gum, shoved it back in his mouth, and wearily meandered off. "Oh my God, look at that!" yelled a fat woman with inches of slip showing beneath her skirt. "Yes, wonderful what they get up to, ain't it?" bellowed her companion. The old man in the wheelchair snorted with disgust. An elderly lady standing in front gave a sudden start with fright at the sound. Just then there was a sudden lurch and groceries cascaded all around. "Yeah, was going too fast," shrilled a tattered woman. "Didn't see ya at all, I didn't. Yeah, was going too fast." The old man, whose wheelchair had been quite stationary, moved off. "Ugh," he muttered to himself. "Let me get going and finish the book. Then perhaps we can look for a saner place than British Columbia." Another old man was dying. Lying on his bed in the dark. 170. End room. He watched with fast diminishing sight the gleam of light high up where the curtains did not completely obscure sunlight. A shaft of light struck across the room and made just a splotch on the dingy paint. The old man stirred restlessly, almost mindlessly. He was in no pain. Instead there was a sensation of cold creeping upwards, from his feet to his knees, higher. Dully he wondered when the angels would gather about him. He had been an ardent believer in his religion all his life. He believed in angels, he believed that at his passing he would go to the pearly gates, he believed. The light faded as if a cloud had passed across the face of man, was now feeling the cold as of ice, creeping upwards past his hips, up to his waist. Slowly, slowly, it reached up towards his heart. Like a sunburst, light enveloped the room. He gazed about him with eyes which were fast going blind. Shadowy figures were about him, figures with wings. There was the rustling of voices, not understandable to him yet because he was seeing this through a filmy gauze veil. The cold crept up and struck at his heart. With a last convulsive gasp, the old man started finally to die as his heart stopped and his lungs ceased to pulse. Now conditions were speeded up because with the cessation of breathing there was the termination of oxygen to the brain. The physical body twitched in the last nervous reactions, twitched without the old man feeling the twitches, without any pain. He was now beyond pain, beyond feeling in the body. The blind eyes, now dead eyes, stared upward motionless. Within the body there was the rustling of fluids and the sighing of winds. There was crepitation as joints loosened, as muscles relaxed their tense grip on life. Slowly a bluish-white mist emerged from the dead body and coalesced into an intangible form over the head. It became more distinct, firmer, in the shape of a nude human, an old, old man racked with suffering. But as it coalesced and became firmer, the outlines became smoother, more youthful, more tranquil. 171. Gradually the connecting cord, the silver cord, thinned, frayed, and parted. The newly coalesced astral form hesitated a moment, then gradually, with a slight jerk, started into motion, going faster and faster into an unknown plane. The old man in life had been a close follower of his religion. He hadn't believed in reincarnation. He had believed in the resurrection of the body at the Day of Judgment. He believed that all bodies buried or burned eventually were collected together and clothed again with flesh, even after 10,000 years. Now in the astral form he was lost, lost and wandering, victim to the fallacious beliefs to which he had subscribed for so long. He believed in nothing but the dead resting in their lonely graves or collected in little piles of ashes from the crematoriums, but he was alive, alive in a different shape. About him he saw alternately black fog of nothingness, and then when a little doubt about his religion came into his awareness, he saw another facet of his religion, angels. Desperately he fastened on the idea of angels. Reluctantly he threw aside the thought of resurrection. What was resurrection to him? He was alive, wasn't he, in a different state? But he could see angels, couldn't he? So what was this talk about resurrection? Let him live for the moment, he thought, and then he seemed to drop to the ground. His feet, astral feet? Spirit feet? They felt very solid to him. The ground felt soft and springy and warm to his bare feet. But he dropped to the ground and the veil was drawn aside. He looked about him. Angels were flying through the air, cherubims were sitting on clouds. Great choirs were singing with monotonous repetition. Away in the distance he saw golden light. Away in the distance he saw the pearly gates. Swiftly he moved into action, running across the springy turf, inexorably drawing nearer to the pearly gates. At last, after an unspecified time, he reached those monumental edifices which towered so high above him. A gleaming figure outside with a flashing sword of golden light barred the way. "Who are you?" asked a voice. The old man gave his name. From just inside the gate another sparkling figure opened a great book and, moistening his thumbs with his lips, rifled through the pages. "Ah, yes. 172. said the second voice. "Yes, we expected you here. Enter." The great book of records was closed. The pearly gates were opened, and the old man, now a young naked man, entered. For some time the newly arrived visitor was in a state of ecstasy at the realization of all that his religion had taught him. Angels, cherubims, seraphims. The heavenly host singing in multi-layered choirs, Street Peter, the recording angel, and the great book of all knowledge wherein was kept the record of every soul upon earth, in which was recorded the good and the bad of every person who had ever lived. Gradually, though, the old man, now the newest visitor, began to feel uneasy. There were inconsistencies. This was not real, this was pantomime, this was stage stuff. Where had he gone wrong? Was it something wrong with his religion? Then the thought came to him about resurrection. Well, he thought to himself, is this as ungenuine as resurrection? What about resurrection? How could dead bodies which had long rotted away be reassembled at the last trump of a great bugle? Where would all those people stand? How would they be clothed? How would they be fed? And this angelic host, this glimpse of heaven, disappointing place, I'm beginning to doubt my senses. No sooner had he said that to himself than there was a great clap as of thunder, and the whole edifice fell around him with broken shards of the pearly gates and the golden light extinguished. But, stop! Exclamation mark. A greater light came on. The old man, now a visitor, looked about him in awe. This was more like it. Running towards him, he saw people whom he had known in his last life on earth, people he had loved. He saw a beloved pet coming towards him and jumping up at him and shouting with delight. Another figure came towards him and said, "Ah, now you are released from your delusions. Now you have reached a true home, the land of the golden light. Here you will sojourn for a while you and you alone decide what you want to do." So it is that many religions lead one astray. So it is that one can read of any religion and learn thereby, but the true wisdom, 173, comes in keeping an open mind, so that when the time comes for the transition from this life to another, you, and you, and you, everyone can go to the state for which his or her evolution and attainment have fitted him. For in the greater plan of things, even those who have passed over have to be protected from their own folly. If a person believes that he will go to an imaginary heaven, then it will be put on show for him until he sees the flaws. If a person thinks that he is going to a land of ineffable delights where dancing girls are always there to entertain him, then he will have such things put on for him until he outgrows such transient things. And if a woman's lib leader had as her idea of heaven a place where all men are slaves, then no doubt that also could be produced for her. And such plays can go on until the person concerned eventually comes to see the fallacy of such stage acts, until such time as the person concerned grows up spiritually and mentally and can accept the land of the golden light for what it is, a place of reality, a place different yet not so different as that which they so recently left. A place with the evil purged out, a place where one can only meet those who are compatible, a place where there is no hatred, no enmity, no poverty, and no suffering. A place where one, in full awareness of one's acts, judges one's past endeavors and failings and decides what shall be done in the future. But the clack of the typewriter must cease. The platen must no longer be twirled, and the papers must not be fed in and pulled out, typed, for the allotted span of this book has come to pass. Now it has to be sent to respected agent Knight to pass on to respected publisher. Miss Cleopatra Ramper sighed with relief as she turned to Taddy Ramper. "Oh, thank goodness," she said. "Now he's got rid of this stuff, perhaps he'll have time for us. It remains then to do only two more tasks. The first is to thank Mrs. Ramper for her constant vigilance in reading the typescript and checking slight errors. And secondly, one must really thank Mrs. Sheila Rouse, a loyal companion throughout the years, for the hard work she has done in typing all this for us." The end.